like from the hoarding studies, I could see with augmented reality that people could practice their discarding in their real environment and be able to do that. You know, people with phobias, they're afraid of spiders. They could be in their own home, in their environments where the fear is really maladaptive, you know, bring the spiders on. Or I think it'll just add flexibility to the simulations that we can do and make them more realistic and maybe more applicable to their problems.
Welcome to the Future of Psychiatry podcast, where we explore novel technology and new innovations in mental health. I'm your host, Dr. Bassey, an addiction physician and biomedical engineer. Today, we are with Kim Bullock. Dr. Bullock is the founder and director of Stanford's Neurobehavioral Clinic and Virtual Reality and Immersive Technologies Program. She is also a leader and pioneer in telehealth services using XR. She has published many peer-reviewed articles and is a Cambridge and Oxford Press author on the subject of functional neurologic disorders. Her primary clinical research interest is exploring the use of technology for trauma treatment and psychiatric illnesses involving the disruption of bodily perception and function. She is currently focused on the use and dissemination of immersive technologies for telepsychiatry, as well as its use in augmentation of physiotherapy, psychotherapy, and skills acquisition. She's also the host of the podcast called Psychiatry XR, which is a podcast specifically dedicated to utilizing VR to treat psychiatric illnesses, and has explored various topics such as virtual body ownership, body transfer experiences, chronic pain treatment, and utilizing wearables. So if anyone is interested in that, please check out Psychiatry XR. I feel really lucky to have Dr. Kim Bullock on the show. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I feel lucky to be here.
We have very much overlapping interests. My podcast is interested in any sort of technology that is pushing the needle forward in our treatment. I feel like virtual reality is so underutilized, mainly because people don't know very much about it. But once they try it once, they're a believer almost immediately. I know you have an interesting story as to how you got involved in it. It seems like you're a believer now as well. Can you tell us a little bit briefly about that? And we'll jump right into all your wisdom that you have in utilizing VR to treat psychiatric illnesses.
It actually started back in my undergraduate days at UC San Diego, when I had Ramachandran as a professor who was a neurologist and a physician and a perceptual psychology researcher, and taught about the rubber hand illusions and then mirror therapy that could amputate phantom limbs. And that class really got me interested in going to medical school. I was like, oh, okay, this is something worth pursuing. It didn't seem boring and it seemed relevant. It came around that after I did my medical school training and psychiatry training and went into kind of a field, I thought I was going to be a neurologist, and then pivoted at the last minute. I got wise and decided to go into psychiatry because I thought it was more challenging and there was more things to do. Then I ended up researching that the diagnosis that's kind of at the interface of psychiatry and neurology, which is functional neurological disorder, used to be called conversion disorder, and also the roots of psychiatry come from that diagnosis. And then also ending up combining perceptual illusions as a possible treatment using virtual reality, kind of an extension of Ramachandran initial research. That's kind of how I got into VR. I did a trial. It was trying to enhance physiotherapies for our patients with FND. We were doing groups, but they were having trouble getting access to physiotherapy. And it seemed like we didn't have enough somatic interventions. So we did a trial of mirror visual feedback on them. And that's how I got involved with VR, because we had a virtual human interaction lab at Stanford with Jeremy Bailenson. And they were trying that out, mirror therapy for chronic pain. And so they helped me try it out on some patients with FND. And then we did a clinical trial. And then we did some cue desensitization for people with triggers to their psychogenic movement disorders using VR. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into this, but I kind of pivoted now into anxiety disorders in our clinic as well. Still, half my practice is functional neurological disorders.
Well, you're attracted to challenges by nature, it sounds like, and you're attracted to one of the most difficult to treat areas within psychiatry. It's really not as straightforward treating a functional disorder as something like a phobia of going over a bridge. How do you go about utilizing VR to treat conversion disorder, psychogenic seizure, functional abdominal pain, things of that nature? Where do you start?
I wasn't sure that you could, but you're right. I've been called an early adopter, but I think I'm an adventurer, and I come from a long line of people with addictions, including myself. So we probably have some like dopamine addiction to challenges, but I think it's just my Viking roots or something. I like being on the edge where there's uncertainty. We were not sure whether virtual reality would actually help people with FND, and it's still being studied. It hasn't been established yet. So we did a pilot study of mere visual feedback, which is for unilateral motor and sensory symptoms, to see if those would improve with mirror therapy. And there seemed to be a little improvement, but actually we added cue desensitization, and that seemed to be the most effective for people with functional disorders because they could desensitize to their cues. For some people, going through a narrow hallway or something has them buckle their knees. A lot of this is also connected to PTSD. If somebody who only has symptoms in large settings or a sports arena, we could simulate the sports arena and have them practice going to the sports arena over and over, not avoiding it. And then eventually the symptoms would abate. But again, it's not an established, we haven't done a randomized controlled trial. So we're not using VR for FND and anything but research still.
Let's talk a little bit about treating addiction with VR. Obviously, people, places, and things, that's one thing that's often mentioned as an addiction psychiatrist, is working through those triggers that lead to a craving. Essentially, it's almost like a similar response that anxious folks get when they're triggered by something. It's like the amygdala or any sort of deeper part of the brain starts to take over and they start acting on impulsive urges that they're not necessarily thinking out with their prefrontal cortex. So I've heard of VR being utilized for going into a bar or walking by a bar and things of that nature. But can you tell me a little bit about your experience with utilizing it for addiction?
Yeah, well, given that I'm a certified DBT therapist, I'm a radical behaviorist. So I think everything is a behavior. You know, an urge to have a drink, using a substance is a behavior, having an emotion is a behavior, a thought is a behavior. And everything is conditionable through classical and operant conditioning. Kind of have this software that's been so great, and because it's gotten us to adapt to things and be flexible and agile in any environment, but it also has a downside because we can easily get conditioned to things that aren't adaptive. That's kind of how I see addictions and any other problematic symptoms that people have. There's been a lot of work outside the United States in using VR for addiction. I personally have not used it in our clinics. Occasionally, I might use some VR for a patient. Acceptability of VR is one of the biggest barriers right now, and we have not been able to convince the psychologist, at least in our system, to be using VR regularly with addiction folks or people with psychosis. I've used it a handful of times for maybe cue desensitization. So we can simulate being somewhere else that might be a cue or a prompter for urges or for not being able to refuse a substance like a drink. You had Xavier Palomar from Amelia on. That's my favorite platform. I don't have any conflicts of interest, unfortunately, with them, but they seem to be the only platform that's really ready for prime time. And they have some cue desensitization, like being in a bar and practicing refusal skills. So I think that interpersonal skill of being able to observe your limits, communicate limits and say no, or just to desensitize to some of the prompters that cause urges and behaviors is super important. And then there's emotion regulation skills that you can teach folks that struggle with habits and addictions involving distress tolerance and relaxation skills, mindfulness skills. So often we'll do that just for kind of emotion regulation or be able to urge surf and things like that. But again, I'm not an expert on addiction and I don't see too many people with addiction come through my clinic.
There's also an accessibility challenge with having the resources available to utilize that and maybe finding the appropriate therapist who knows how to do it. But you mentioned acceptability, which is understanding why VR would be a benefit and why therapists' efforts and maybe going out of their way to get the VR system set up and convincing a patient, talking to the patient about it and training themselves how to use it, training the patient how to use it, why all of those things are valuable and important in the long run in treating that patient. But that's just off the top of my head. What have you seen as the challenges in acceptability of the VR system?
Yeah, we don't see much problems with acceptability from the consumers, but it's the providers. And I don't think that we know why, but my guess, it's a training gap. So if you don't have it in a training program, you don't have standards, you don't have best practices, then people are going to be not as trusting. And it's novel and it's new and it takes a long time for people to change. And so I do feel like it's basically if we could get it into the training curriculum and standardize that, maybe through the ACGME or something, then I think it would be a no-brainer. And it's not even very expensive to add to your practice. You know, a subscription is less than $1,000 a year and probably would get a better flow and it's good PR for people at private practice. So I do think it's just a kind of psychological thing that if not everybody's doing it, I better not do it. And the novelty takes a long time for behaviors to change.
That's a good point. I'm almost seeing some parallels to the adoption of Zoom.
Yeah, right. Just a few years ago, everybody thought this telehealth was kind of dangerous and maybe not a good thing to do and might interfere with treatment.
I've gotten the stereotype that a telehealth doctor is really not as thorough or knowledgeable. They're like probably cutting corners. Oh, you saw a telehealth doctor. They probably didn't really talk to you that much. I've gotten that a lot. They're like, you need to see somebody in person, like as if that in person was better than the telehealth person.
Yes. So it's strange how we all resist change.
I don't know if any of that stigma is carrying over into the VR world, perhaps like it's a little geeky because of the association with gaming world and things of that nature.
Yeah, there's some stigma with that, definitely. And then people think if you do VR in practice, you're just an avatar. You and the patient are an avatar and you never really see the patient. Like the whole thing is automatized into a virtual world, which isn't true. You know, when you see patients, if you do CBT, the amount of time you might do an imaginal exposure might be like 0.1% of the whole time that you do therapy. So the VR, you bring it in as a tool. It's like a Kleenex box or a fancy chair you might use. It's not the whole treatment.
Let's talk about the avatar idea, because I've heard a kind of mixture of things from therapists who are using VR. I heard one person say that, you know, the avatar idea where you're embodied through some sort of a digital representation really takes away too many elements of that interaction. And I've had another therapist who said kind of the opposite, where they would support that because it would allow the therapist work together in that digital space, helping them gain familiarity with that environment and then kind of removing yourself before you become that disembodied voice in just coaching the individual through the virtual space. You want to work with them through that as if you would in real life. I'm in my mind trying to get a little bit more guidance as to which way is necessarily better or what should be recommendations for individuals starting out or considerations even. Like if I'm going to be using an avatar, I want to think of X, Y, and Z with my patient.
There's different ways you can incorporate avatars. So a patient can have an embodied experience and be an avatar in an experience. They're not only just doing head tracking, but they're doing body tracking. So that does require some expensive hardware still. Some people have it at home, or we used to have it when we had our therapy in person. I would have a Vive or something in the office, but we're not using that very much. And then there's a new idea about having the therapist come into a common space and also be an avatar and kind of meet up in a virtual space with the patient. So that's more experimental. I don't think we have as much data about that, and it's more complicated to do. So there's even more barriers, both for the technology that a provider would have to have and the expertise and the acceptability. I see that as coming down the line, but I don't think it's advanced. We don't know enough about it to really deliver it yet in that format. But I guess telehealth itself could start to be avatar driven. I think with this holographic, videographic quality that's coming, that we're probably not even going to need to be a cartoon version of ourselves. There'll probably be holograms of ourselves that will bypass that.
Even Amelia's setups or environments, they have an avatar that's driven by a computer and it has kind of like moving in a way that looks a little unnatural. So I don't see why it would be a disadvantage or a drawback to have a person in the digital environment with the patient and have it maybe look a little bit more realistic and have there be more real-time reactions to what the patient's saying and doing.
The technical barrier would be like you also want to be watching the patient to make sure they don't fall or something. So if you've got a headset on too and they've got a headset, there's also some security concerns. So I think it would be complicated. You might need a third person or something to make sure, because you want to also be knowing how they're doing in real life. And if you're both in a virtual world, you're losing some real life. Maybe with augmented layered kinds of realities, you could do that where you could be both in there, but also seeing the patient. But my concern about that at this point is when they're fully immersed, you just want to make sure they're safe and they're not running into something or they're not going to fall or something. I think there's just a technical barrier right now. But yeah, I agree. It would be great. I could see all sorts of uses to be in there. And I think psychosis too, they're really using that in their paradigms, in the research paradigms really well, and helping people both desensitize to social interactions and they can control the kind of social interaction with the therapist embodying or controlling an avatar. Maybe that would be more of a workaround, is like, you're not actually embodied in there, but you can control another avatar that's in their space. And so they're able to reappraise and also have distress tolerance, people with psychosis. And I think there's a lot of room as well for the executive retraining and using VR and gamifying it, because I hear it's really boring to do.
What is that term, executive retraining?
For psychosis, cognitive enhancement therapy. Sorry, maybe I'm saying it wrong. You know, building brain capacity through computer exercises, that's been shown to help with cognitive functions, like like ability to organize and things like that for people with psychosis. So being able to translate that intervention into a VR therapy, it could gamify it, make it more fun, make it more interactive. There's a lot of potential for that.
There's very few therapists who I feel like are appropriately trained to use a CBT approach for treating psychosis. Even for somebody who's really well qualified, it's very nuanced to understand the psychotic, what their conceptualization is of reality and getting into all of the details of their perspective on reality.
And so I think that's the problem with psychiatrists. We're already way behind the curve in even learning CBT. And to use VR effectively right now in an evidence-based way, you really got to know how to do CBT. So first you got to learn CBT and then the VR. So like in our clinics have Kate Hardy, who actually disseminates CBT for psychosis. And I think their priority right now is just that, even though she's interested in adding the VR, you first got to disseminate the CBT for psychosis, which is still hasn't been fully implemented or expanded.
Individuals who probably have gone most of their life without addressing that psychosis with therapy in any way. It's usually helping with the most basic of needs, just getting a quantitative assessment of how often the voices are happening.
Who would think to put it in like an exposure paradigm too? The VR does it really operationalizes that exposure component because that's a radical idea, but pretty effective. Actually, psychosis has the best research supporting that VR is superior to therapy without. Most of the other treatments can enhance the speed or maybe the dropout. It enhances the therapy, but you don't get superior results. But there's some evidence mounting that actually VR enhances, has superior results in psychosis.
I think some people are maybe just afraid of VR because I think they think the patient's going to be just confused. So it shouldn't be like an absolute contraindication to treating a patient. It shouldn't just be like a flat out no, like this patient has psychosis, therefore we can never use VR with them. Like anything, we need to be careful, start low and go slow, like we say with medications. Like nothing's truly off the table. We've always used things off label if we can just make sure that the patient and the clinician is very well educated as to how it's being used.
Well, I think it's like at NAVOA, who would have thought that you should talk about your trauma. That would help people. You know, these people are doing these things that are just go against common sense that then work. And that I think that a psychosis one and avatars, you would think that would be the worst thing to do for somebody who's not in touch with reality is put them in a non-real world.
Let's talk about side effects because you mentioned people falling off the chair. Maybe silly stuff like that happens, which maybe it's not silly, but they can get a head trauma. But what's like the worst case type of side effects that you've experienced? Maybe not frequently, but like nausea, administer Zofran type of thing, or just get like give them a break from it. What kinds of things are you looking out for?
It doesn't happen very often, even though it's reported to happen pretty often. In my anecdotal experience, it doesn't happen very often if you keep the exposure, you know, less than 20 minutes. But so the side effects could be cyber sickness, which they think may be due to the sensory conflict between perception and vestibular systems and expectations. It does look like there might be a lot of kind of like a psychosomatic component to it. So we still don't understand cyber sickness, dry mouth, salivation, apathy, disorientation. So you have some autonomic nervous system, sometimes in a very small percentage, visual disturbance or visual fatigue, postural instability, lucid dreaming. A lot of people talk about lucid, the gamers. So a lot of this evidence comes from like gamers who do it for like 2 days straight, you know, and drinking coffee and, you know, these young people that's whose frontal lobes aren't fully myelinated and they're not assessing risks properly. And so they'll be in virtual worlds for a long time. So they get lucid dreaming. There are these cases of people that are in embodied body swapping, body transfer experiences that talk about having sensory symptoms the next day where maybe they can't feel their hands as well. So I do think that we need to study these embodied illusions more. So that's why I'm a little cautious about full avatar experiences, because I think our body image and motor and sensory systems are so linked. So you can have these weird things that we don't fully understand yet. I know that even in rubber hand illusions, people have a histamine effect and kind of inflammatory effect to the disembodied hand through an illusion. So our perceptions and our immune systems are linked, and probably all sorts of systems are linked that we don't understand. So I do think we have to be very cautious.
That's a really good reminder, because even I know that there's real physiologic changes to a placebo effect. It's like your mind is telling you that something is happening and your body is actually making real changes. And I'm imagining same thing can happen with the rubber hand effect or virtual reality. I mean, in one sense, we're using virtual reality to kind of desensitize somebody to pain. Who's to say that maybe it couldn't go too far in the wrong direction and like they become desensitized to other sensory experiences, tactile experiences with their hand or arm?
Right now, the way we have it set up with just the head tracking, cyber sickness, they say it's like 1% to 5% of people, and it usually comes early in the VR treatment. I would say for me, it's maybe 1%. What increases the likelihood is like textured scenes or low quality, ages 2 through 12, comorbid migraine, self-reported motion sickness. And then it's really recommended that you start with just 10 minutes, the first VR use. And if people do get it, it's kind of like being seasick. I also sail too. I think it's my Viking gene. But if anybody has seasickness, you just have them start steering the boat and it goes away. I've never seen it not work. It's the same with VR. The more autonomous control you have, the more interaction and control in the environment, the less likely you're going to have cyber sickness. So having people stand up or start to do something, it's kind of this drive for autonomy. So the more passive the experience, the more likely that people have it. So often I'll have somebody like stand up or something, or try to do something that's more active, or just take the thing off and just relax. There are cases of, luckily I haven't had any, but I always worry that it might happen, like disembarkment syndrome, where people, you know, go on a cruise, they get seasick and then they never get better. They're seasick the rest of their life. Usually it's like a month or two, but there are cases and I'm sure that's going to happen. But so we have to be careful. And really, I only had it with one student that I was training. Well, I was doing a workshop with these international students and this young girl put it on for less than a minute and she got severely sick. But that's the only time I've had cyber sickness.
Kind of made me think of doing consent. We should be doing informed consent, right? I mean, these are rare, but I guess people should know.
I've spent 2 years working with the Stanford Compliance Center. I hope my Stanford department is listening. They can. This is so new. They don't know what to do with it. They aren't able to help me figure out what kinds of consents or anything to do. But I do think, yeah, you have to be just honest and have conversations at this point, but there isn't any standard consent forms.
I think it's actually required by certain state laws now to say that the patient, we obtained consent, that the patient agreed to virtual care and that they acknowledge that other people in their vicinity could potentially hear them.
Oh yeah, we have that. Yeah, the telehealth has been kind of pretty standardized. Yeah, telehealth. Yeah, now that everybody's on board. Hopefully that'll happen once we get virtual therapies using VR.
I'm just thinking it's a matter of time before we have one fairly standard universal consent form for VR types of therapy with motion sickness and other perceptual issues. What other types of disorders are you most excited about using VR for? I know a couple other ones that we haven't really talked much detail about is eating disorders and then the functional disorders in more detail. I know you have a more of a research-oriented approach to that, but do you think that this is something that more clinicians should be eventually picking up and saying, hey, this is a good tool. I feel like we're short on tools in this field here. We don't really have a whole lot of tools to go off of. Why don't we embrace this thing that could potentially help a lot of patients who are otherwise untreated?
I'm really excited about the eating disorders world. So I'm not an eating disorder specialist, but my friends in the eating disorder clinics at Stanford have been able to accept VR and are doing studies. And I think that we're going to be able to launch them very soon. And so because with eating disorders, there's like three components. So people, you know, are inaccurate about their body. They have body distortions. They have body dissatisfaction, even if they're not distorted. And that's one of the hardest symptoms. And then there's just eating itself, like either giving in to urges or not giving in to urges. The easiest thing, and has the most evidence, and that our clinics have been able to adapt from Riva Giuseppe's work in Italy, and they did a kind of cultural adaptation for the US, has been cue desensitization. So helping people with refractory binge eating disorder that didn't respond to traditional CBT and helping them desensitize to their own cues and their own foods. So that's one low-hanging fruit. But the thing that seems to persist, even when people get control of their eating, is body dissatisfaction. And what's Riva Giuseppe has really done tremendous work, as well as his colleagues, about possibly this allosteric lock theory, at which your body image is actually created from implicit biases, what you think your body looks like to other people, from your culture, from your experiences, and then also from the bottom up, your interoceptive sensations and how you're feeling. So these two come together and they create your body image. But some of that, a kind of top down from implicit biases, gets stuck and it doesn't, can't model update. If like, you know, you were 6 years old and somebody told you were fat and now you're a regular BMI person in your 30s, you can't get rid of that experience. And so it never updates. And so they're experimenting with some, both retraining these experiences and kind of like talking about them in an avatar. But the more compelling to me is this implicit bias reprogramming. Because, you know, most of therapy, you have to think about it and do it on your own. But embodied experiences can change implicit biases. So you can go into an experience, if you have the characteristics of that person, you will start to behave like that person. It's the Proteus effect. Jeremy Balinson has talked about these experiences. Like if somebody goes and wears a cape in an avatar, a fully embodied experience, they see that they do more helping behaviors the week following that experience. And same with racial biases, that you can change through Stroop testing people's biases. So you can do that towards your own body too. So they have people who are morbidly obese trying to lose weight get into an avatar of a kind of average weight person. And you would think that that would be super disturbing, right? And after that experience, they would get out of it and just be more dissatisfied with their body. Well, the opposite is true. They feel better about their body and they actually translates to better health behaviors after it. So it's changing something in their model, this allosteric lock theory is what's proposed. So to me, those kinds of things about transforming implicit biases, because, you know, beliefs are really hard to change. We can change some of them with intention, but if we can change them passively in that reptilian level with conditioning, that would be just such a game changer. So those kind of body swapping experiences have profound effects. So because when you embody something with certain characteristics, you change your belief around that, those characteristics. They've done that for racial profiling, like having an experience of a homeless person or having an experience as a Black person changes your beliefs about that group.
Well, even with somebody who has pain in a particular arm, I saw your interview, was it on NBC or some other really big network, where they were popping the balloons using their functional hand. And then that gave them the belief that they can use their non-functional hand.
Yeah, it actually reduced the pain. But I think that's happening. It's through this motor M1 pathway. So mirror therapy is actually been shown to really help with pain and function because it activates on the same side something called the M1 pathway. So the illusion itself changes in the motor cortex. Yeah.
This is why we're in psychiatry. We love geeking out about these topics because there's so much potential there. And I think also we need to do more research because I think there's going to be a lot of critics who say you're going to worsen people's self-image because it's like, well, if they apply that thought process, well, look at like Instagram. There's all these like perfect bodies out there. Or I mean, magazines, that's what they were saying 10, 15 years ago. But that wasn't the person's own body, you know, in a VR setting. That's, I think, the key difference there is that they're judging what they're seeing on a screen or in a magazine versus what they're seeing on their own body. And what you're talking about is that they look down and they see a different body in the VR world.
Yeah, that's an egocentric experience as opposed to an allocentric experience where you're looking at yourself. For looking at somebody else. Because you could be in VR and have an allocentric experience where you're looking at two avatars or looking at yourself, like being Freud. Daniel Friedman has that one where you become Freud listening to yourself. So there's these different perspectives that may have different effects. And this is where I think psychiatrists need to get involved. I cannot find a VR company in mental health space that has a psychiatrist. I've been begging to be an advisor. I can't even get a conflict of interest. I mean, people need to know what's going on and we need to be studying this. We need to know what happens clinically. And psychologists are great, but there's some information that psychiatrists know about the body or neurology that needs to get into the conversation. We really need to have some input into designing what's happening in the future. And I think you're part of that.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I remember being at the APA conference in New Orleans a couple of years ago, and there was a talk about technology and psychiatry. And there were so many psychiatrists in the room. They're like, how do I get involved? Like, how do I talk to the people at these companies? It was this mismatch between like 100 psychiatrists in this room wanting to get involved in some way. And then, you know, you look at the advisory board of these companies and it's mostly people who have a business background. This is probably part of the reason why I did this podcast. It allows me to have these conversations where otherwise I would never have been able to talk to the founder of a particular technology. And so that part is really cool. I'm sure you're having the same experience.
Yeah, that's exactly why I did the podcast. Yeah. I'm so glad you're doing it. Yeah. We're in a crisis with our identity as psychiatrists going forward, and we really need to be thinking about these things and how we fit in and what we're going to do.
What about guidelines for VR? Do you think there's going to be any guidelines set for what clinicians could follow? I feel like sometimes there's a thirst for that to standardize an approach, maybe to feel like this is what other clinicians came up with as a safe mechanism that maybe makes me feel more comfortable going into doing this. Do you know of anything out there on that?
No, I think the APA, the psychologists, are probably closer to doing that. But I think because the hardware is changing all the time, that it makes it hard to have these guidelines. Maybe if the market settles down and we get one or two devices that stick around. But I do think some professional organizations need to get to be a critical mass in a professional organization to create the standards, and then it needs to go into training programs. I think the critical mass isn't there. And I think also because the technology is changing so rapidly.
And just to explore that topic a little bit more, you mentioned there's a lot of devices on the market. Within a couple of the top ones, the top headsets, is the experience a whole lot different, like from the patient's perspective, that would actually change the guidelines?
We thought the Quest was going to be, you know, the game changer, but onboarding is so difficult. So we're all waiting for this Apple device, and Apple might be the game changer. I think everybody's, you know, kind of holding off to really develop things until that Apple headset becomes available. I haven't tried it yet, but I think Apple has kind of, again, I'm not getting paid by them or anything, but they do have better privacy issues. They've delved into risks more, and they're a bit more cautious, and they're coming late to the game because they're doing their research. I think once Apple's in there, we might, hopefully, we're pretty disappointed by the Quest.
Apple's really excels at the augmented reality. Correct. Can you, for the listener, maybe talk a little bit about how that would change the clinical approach with a patient using an augmented reality paradigm versus a completely virtual paradigm?
I think it would be easier for us clinicians because we wouldn't have to be worried about them falling and everything. And they could use their own environment. Like from the hoarding studies, I could see with augmented reality that people could practice their discarding in their real environment and then be able to do that. You know, people with phobias, they're afraid of spiders. They could be in their own home, in their environments where the fear is really maladaptive. And, you know, bring the spiders on, or I think it'll just add flexibility to the simulations that we can do and make them more realistic and maybe more applicable to their problems.
That's really cool. That's really smart. I hadn't thought of those types of applications. That makes a lot of sense.
That's it for this episode. I'd appreciate it if you please like and share this podcast with your colleagues. It'd be especially helpful for us. If you'd like, please leave us a rating on your favorite podcatcher. If you're a clinician, I developed a course on how to start a private practice. And for patients, I've also developed a course on acceptance and commitment therapy and cognitive behavioral based therapy lessons for treating and helping anxiety. You can find all these on our website as well as the show notes and resources for each episode. Thank you so much, and I'll see you in the next episode.